From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The entire House Republican Conference went to the White House today to talk about the debt with President Obama. The conversation was described as very frank. That's usually Washington code for frosty. The meeting came just a day after the House voted overwhelmingly not to raise the nation's debt ceiling. To win over some Republican votes and to make sure the nation doesn't default for the first time, the White House is trying to negotiate a deficit reduction package. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports.
The House Republicans came to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in a caravan of big blue buses after their 70-minute closed-door meeting with the president, a meeting that some of them described as chilly. The Republicans emerged into the sweltering heat, and House Speaker John Boehner gave this readout.
I think it was an opportunity for clearly our members to communicate directly with the president about our ideas about how we solve the debt problem that's facing our country. I've told the president one more time, this is the moment. This is the window of opportunity where we can deal with this on our terms. We can work together and solve this problem. We know what the problems are. Well, let's not kick the can down the road one more time.
President Obama could have said the same thing, and he has many times. But although both parties do agree on the problem, they don't agree on the solution. Here's House Majority Leader Eric Cantor.
Well, the president talked about a need for us to continue to, quote unquote, invest from Washington's standpoint. And to a lot of us, that's code for more Washington spending, something that we can't afford right now.
The Republicans repeated their long-held positions in the debt ceiling talks, that spending be cut $2 trillion over 10 years, no tax increases, and they want the president to agree to significant reforms in Medicare, the biggest driver of the deficit. Democrats say they're open to some kinds of Medicare changes, but not unless Republicans agree to more revenues, either tax hikes or a limit to tax loopholes. Sounds like the two parties are at the same old standstill, but White House Press Secretary Jay Carney decided to put the best possible spin on the meeting between the president and his Republican adversaries.
This is part of a process that's very productive and helps reduce, I think, some of the, you know, confrontational atmosphere that surrounds some of these discussions. It doesn't mean that we don't disagree on some fundamental issues. Of course we do. And we've been very clear and we haven't papered over our differences, and neither have they.
Both sides have been reassuring the financial markets that the debt ceiling will be raised. But the White House and the Republicans are still far from a deal that would allow that to happen. And, says budget expert Stan Collender, the Republicans in particular don't have much room for compromise.
Because of the Tea Party folks, they cannot possibly agree to an increase in the debt ceiling, no matter what it includes, until the very last minute. So it looks like they've driven the hardest possible bargain.
If Republicans agree to a deal too early, it may look like they left something on the table, says Collender. He thinks the markets may have to react to give the two sides an incentive to come together.
In some respects, that's what they need politically. That is, members of Congress who want to vote, you know, would like to vote for the debt ceiling, need some excuse to be able to do that. And a market being spooked would allow them.
The Treasury Department says the U.S. will default if Congress and the White House don't reach agreement by August 2nd. Collender predicts the markets will start getting nervous if there's no deal by around the third week of July. Investors could stop buying U.S. debt, and while that might help scare negotiators out of their stalemate, it could also spark a rise in interest rates that might not be easy to reverse, and that would raise U.S. borrowing costs and make it even harder to reduce the debt. So the talks continue. Tomorrow, it's the House Democrats' turn to meet with the president. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, we find out the latest from Yemen, whose president has been counted as a U.S. ally, even as anti-Western terrorist groups are believed to have based operations there. Now, as the anti-government protests that have swept the Arab world reach that country, there's talk of civil war. We'll get perspective from Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, and from Washington. But first, back to a pressing but less visible crisis here at home. This Sunday is the day, 30 years ago, that HIV/AIDS was first recognized as a distinct disease. Back then, patients who were diagnosed with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, were essentially living out a death sentence. They were told there was nothing that could be done for them. But the development of powerful drugs have allowed millions of HIV-positive people to lead long and productive lives. Now, we've talked often on this program about the quest to get these life-enhancing medicines into the hands of people around the world. However, the drugs also remain out of reach for many Americans. Last week, The Washington Post reported a record number of people are on state waiting lists to help them get and pay for the drugs that treat HIV/AIDS. More than 8,300 people across the country. Thomas Decker is on one of those waiting lists in Virginia. He's lived with HIV since 1992. Since January of this year, he's been lucky enough to get his medication through a voluntary program run by a pharmaceutical company. But if the company decides to stop that program and the state doesn't select him for government help, what will he do?
I guess the only other option is board a bus and go to Canada or Mexico. Most drugs are, even for older people, are prohibitively expensive, let alone any of your HIV/AIDS medications. You're talking $4,000 or more a month, which is, you know, it's not feasible.
We caught up with Thomas Decker of Virginia with the help of the Washington Post. But we want to turn now to the state with the highest number of people on the HIV/AIDS drug waiting list, Florida. The state also has one of the highest rates of new infection in the country. We wanted to find out how HIV-positive patients are faring in that state, so we've called Thomas Liberti. He's chief of Florida's Bureau of HIV/AIDS. That's within the state's Department of Health. He's managed public health programs in Florida for more than 35 years. He joins us now from WFSU in Tallahassee. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Jason King, a patient advocate and pharmacy specialist with AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Florida. His organization treats patients who have HIV and AIDS and also advocates for funding and services. He's at member station WLRN in Miami. And welcome to you, Jason. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So, Thomas Liberti, let me start with you. Do you know why the waiting list is so long in Florida?
Well, there have been a number of factors going on in our state along with other parts of the country for the last 4 years. As been reported in the past, we really have the perfect storm going on in the United States and in Florida. We have a long and deep ongoing recession. We have flat funding from the federal government on the money that we get for purchasing the drugs for the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. We have flat funding or reduced funding in some states from the general revenue standpoint. We have a massive amount of unemployment. Our unemployment in the state of Florida was approximately 4.5% before the recession, and we peaked at 12.3%, which included 1.1 million Floridians. We also have 4 million Floridians without health insurance in our state. The National Institute of Health guidelines changed about a year and a half ago, encouraging more early treatment for HIV. And from 2006, most states expanded their counseling and testing programs using the rapid HIV test and routine testing, so more people are coming forward knowing their HIV status earlier.
So you've got more people wanting the drugs, more people being told they should get the drugs. Less money, less insurance, just as you said, a perfect storm. And you recently announced, your office recently announced a proposal to change the income eligibility for the AIDS drug program that people would have to make less than $21,000 annually to qualify for it. As I understand it, hundreds of people came to public hearings, were very impassioned in their opposition to that change. I'll just read one comment from a woman who identified herself as Karen. She came and said, you know, I can't afford a job. As a mother, I have to choose. I have to provide for my children, keep a roof over their heads, give them food. But if I choose to be self-sufficient, my children will slowly watch me die. So, Mr. Liberti, what do you say to somebody like that?
Well, Florida is following a number of steps that other states also are following in the cost containment business of ADAP. Exactly 1 year ago today, we did close the program to new enrollees. A few months after that, we reduced the formulary for HIV drugs from approximately 100 to 50. And one of the things that we did not do was lower the eligibility. So for the last 6 months, we've been exploring the issue of should we, could we, or would we actually lower the eligibility in the state of Florida. We had four public hearings, two in Miami, one in Tampa, and one in Tallahassee, where over 1,000 people came to testify, and it was crystal clear that pretty much 100% of them was opposed to the state reducing the eligibility down to 200%, which would affect about 1,560 individuals. It is actually not our public health recommendation to do that, and we have not filed a rule yet to reduce eligibility in the state of Florida.
So, Jason King, my guess is the people who find themselves in this situation are probably turning to you. What are the people doing who are on the waiting list now? Do they have other sources of medication, or what are they doing?
Well, currently the only option for these patients is to apply directly to the pharmaceutical companies, and that's what I help patients do all day long. And the process can be rather time-consuming. Patients actually have to fill out multiple applications to appeal to all the different manufacturers. Say if you have a patient who's on four different medications that complete their regimen, they have to apply to each one of those manufacturers that produces those different drugs. And every manufacturer has a different income criteria, a different procedure, a different wait time. It could take sometimes weeks for a patient to get all of his or her medication.
And so is it your sense that people are just not taking any medication or not getting any treatment at all while this process goes forward? Is that what you think is happening?
Well, I'll use myself as an example. Before actually being familiar with these programs, I didn't know that they existed. And certainly you could imagine that people do slip through the cracks and don't even realize that they can make use of these programs and still obtain their medication regardless of the fact that the ADEP has an implemented wait list. So, yes, we do suspect that there are many people that just do not have either the mobility or the wherewithal to get to a patient advocate or a case manager to apply for these programs. So people are possibly not taking their medication.
And just as a sense of the scope of this, if you don't mind disclosing this, you told us, I hope you don't mind telling us, how much your medication would cost if you did not have, if you weren't enrolled in some program, Jason.
Not at all. I don't mind talking about it. I did a calculation. The two medications that I take are Truvada and Isentress, and I take them every day. And over the course of the year, they can amount to approximately $30,000 without insurance.
That could be the total. That could wipe out your entire income.
Absolutely, and so, with the possibility of a eligibility reduction, it would be absolutely impossible on my income to be able to afford those medications if I did not have insurance. Fortunately, I do, so I don't have to worry about that. But there are many patients who either have medication regimens where the medication is not covered by their insurance. I just worked with a patient the other day whose one of his medications was not covered, and we did have to apply for patient assistance. And I only take two medications. Keep in mind, we have patients that are sometimes on five different HIV medications. I mean, you could just imagine the astronomical cost of that expenditure.
And Thomas Liberti, just to clarify, now these programs, these AIDS drug assistance programs, ADAPs, are not entitlement programs. It's not that if you meet certain criteria, you have to be enrolled in the program. That's right?
That is correct. It is not similar to food stamps or Medicaid enrollee if you become eligible, which is an entitlement program. Each state gets an allocation from the federal government through the Ryan White Care Act and also applies general revenue money or rebate money to come up with their ADAP budget across the United States. And as we calculate that, then we can figure out approximately how many patients we can take care of each year. Prior to this past crisis with the economy, Florida's ADAP program was open and did not have a wait list for 14 consecutive years. So we were able in the previous environment to have enough federal and state money with an active Medicaid program to take care of the amount of patients. Unfortunately, we're not at that situation right now.
And finally, we only have about a minute and a half left, Mr. Liberti, so I'm going to ask you, what's the worst-case scenario here?
I'm not sure what the worst-case scenario is. I feel like things are getting a little bit better. We're going to do three things to make sure that we help people with HIV and AIDS. We're going to continue to advocate and secure additional funding from the federal government. We're going to maintain, restore, and increase resources for ADAP at the state level, and we're going to continue to work hard with agreements with the pharmaceutical manufacturers to provide stability, and we're going to argue that lower prices are needed.
And Jason, only a minute left for you. What's your final thought here? What's your worst case scenario? Do you think it is going to get better?
I certainly hope so, and I do have faith in Tom Liberty's guidance. The last thing that we would need to do in the case of the reduction of eligibility is take people to Tallahassee and hope this doesn't go through.
Jason King is a pharmacy specialist and patient advocate at AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Florida. He was with us from member station WLRN in Miami. Thomas Liberty is chief of Florida's HIV/AIDS Bureau. He joined us from WFSU in Tallahassee. I thank you both so much for joining us. Good luck to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In Alameda, California, an island city just east of San Francisco, residents are demanding answers. They want to know why a man drowned at a city beach in full view of police and firefighters. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Witnesses say an apparently distraught 53-year-old Raymond Zack paced back and forth along the beach just before noon on Memorial Day. Then he waded into the frigid San Francisco Bay. Zack stood about 50 yards offshore in neck-deep water for about an hour. Then his head disappeared below the waterline. Police and firefighters who had responded to a 911 call about the suicide attempt stood on shore, watching and making no attempt to rescue or even contact Zack. Interim Alameda Fire Chief Mike DeRossi says a policy in place since 2009 forbids his firefighters from rescuing people in the water.
Previously, we had a very highly trained water rescue program that we could use for both shore-based, boat-based, and swift water rescue. But unfortunately, over the course of several years, based from what I can gather on budget issues, they pretty much decertified the program.
A spokesman for the police says officers didn't help because they feared Zack might become violent. Last night, the Alameda City Council received an earful from incredulous residents such as Adam Gillett.
This just strikes me as not just a problem with funding, but a problem with the culture of what's going on in our city, that no one would take the time to help this drowning man.
Adding to the outrage was the fact that even after the tide brought Zack's dead body back near the beach, it took an unidentified passerby to swim out and pull him ashore. Alameda Mayor Marie Gilmore says the city will implement immediately a new policy allowing an on-scene commander to decide how to respond to water distress calls.
This was a really tragic incident. We can't go back and change what happened. We can't defend what happened. What we can do is we can move forward and make sure something like this doesn't happen again.
Gilmore also says the city council will restore funds for training in such emergencies. Thus far, 16 firefighters have volunteered. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Learn more about the music and artists you hear on NPR and discover new music by visiting npr.org/music. There you can also hear a Tiny Desk concert or get an exclusive first listen of new music. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner travels to Capitol Hill today with a warning for freshman lawmakers. Vote to increase the government's credit limit or risk an economic catastrophe. Earlier this week, the House voted overwhelmingly against such increase. Some lawmakers are willing to accept an increase if it comes with deep spending cuts. Others say they believe the government can leave the debt ceiling unchanged without suffering dire consequences. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The Treasury Department is already doing a financial juggling act since bumping up against the current debt ceiling a couple of weeks ago. Officials think they can keep that up for about two more months. But unless Congress votes to increase its borrowing authority by August 2nd, Assistant Treasury Secretary Mary Miller says the government won't be able to pay all of its bills.
We believe that would be quite catastrophic. That has never happened in the history of the U.S. that we have deliberately defaulted on a debt instrument. To default on an obligation would shake the confidence of the global financial markets I believe it would have very long-lasting effects. Once you took that step, you would be unable to ever say you didn't default on something.
But not everyone on Capitol Hill is buying that doomsday scenario.
Failure to raise the debt limit does not equate to a default on our debt at all.
Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania suggests even if the government weren't able to pay all of its bills this summer, it could avoid a default by making sure what money remains available goes to pay bondholders first. It's sort of like skimping on groceries in order to cover your mortgage. In a speech to the American Enterprise Institute, Toomey acknowledged that would create some hardships for those who don't get paid, think Social Security recipients or members of the armed forces. But he says it wouldn't be a financial disaster.
A disruptive series of events is not the same as a catastrophe, and we ought to keep that very much in mind.
But the Obama administration says risking disruptions is playing with fire. Treasury's Miller says government bondholders are likely to get spooked if anyone's payments are cut off. And when bondholders get nervous, the price they demand is higher interest rates from the government and everyone else.
Treasury rates would certainly go up if people lost confidence in Treasury bills and bonds. And those costs, which may look like Wall Street costs, can become very Main Street in the sense that mortgage interest rates, consumer borrowing rates, small business borrowing would all be impacted by that.
Republican leaders insist that any increase in the debt ceiling be accompanied by cuts in future government spending. House Speaker John Boehner pressed that point yesterday after he and his fellow House Republicans met with President Obama.
We had a very frank conversation. I thought it was productive. I'm looking forward to more serious conversations about how we reduce the deficit and the debt and to get our economy going again and creating jobs.
Many of the economic indicators in recent weeks have been worrisome, with a still sputtering job market and a 9% unemployment rate, unlikely to drop much anytime soon. White House spokesman Jay Carney says even as President Obama looks for ways to compromise with Republicans on government spending cuts, he's trying not to slam the brakes on the fragile economic recovery.
The president's view is that we should do nothing in these talks that undermines some of the foundation that we have to have in order to grow in the 21st century, and that's why he feels very strongly we need to protect investments in education, research and development, and infrastructure.
House Republican leader Eric Cantor was skeptical of the president's priorities when he recapped their meeting yesterday in the White House driveway.
The president talked about a need for us to continue to, quote unquote, invest from Washington's standpoint. And to a lot of us, that's code for more Washington spending, something that we can't afford right now.
Vice President Biden has been leading a bipartisan team of lawmakers in search of a budget compromise, which could pave the way for spending cuts and a higher debt limit. The group is not scheduled to meet again, though, until a week from today. And with few signs of movement on either side, the Treasury's juggling act will continue. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.